Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna tell you a little bedtime tale, legend it will become. Burgers flying out the door, sail on. Two for one, no concern for the future. Living for today. Fast food bite on your way, lay it all to waste. The masses are afflicted now. Moo, mad cow, mad cow. Mad cow line dance song.
Hey, Sun Guy Nation, welcome to the show. Sun Guy and QT with you here once again on a Friday afternoon. Real quick, if you're looking for some wrestling, tonight WCWO, like usual, at the Outlaw in Indianapolis, Indiana. And tomorrow night, you can catch me at the Bremerton Eagles. It's on 6th and Washington, brand new venue for PWF. So I will be at the Pro Wrestling Federation. And then also in Circleville, Ohio, tomorrow night, you can find Bobby Fulton's last match. Bobby Fulton of the Fantastics calling it a career. There's going to be a convention and a wrestling show tomorrow night. Huge names taking part. You guys like Kevin Sullivan, the Mass Superstar, Bill Dundee, Jim Cornette, Abyss, Casey Carlisle will be there. Shauna Reed will be there. Definitely check that out tomorrow. It's going to be a huge show. But QT, we are here today to reminisce about the World Wrestling Federation. It was in 1983 that Vincent Kennedy McMahon purchased his father's wrestling company, formerly known as the Worldwide Wrestling Federation. He took what was a regional wrestling promotion and he launched that into a worldwide power. The World Wrestling Federation setting all kinds of attendance records, all kinds of pay-per-view records. Pay-per-view is a new technology he took advantage of early on. He had so many wrestlers that he helped make household names, and we are celebrating that today. And I believe we have someone on the line that was part of that. Do we have the caller on the line?
Yes, we do.
All right, sir. Would you introduce yourself to the listeners here today?
My name is Lanny Popple. I used to be the genius full of glory and renown. Now I'm just an old man living in the past.
Well, Mr. Popple, we're happy to have you take part in this. And just for a little bit of background for the listeners that aren't familiar with how you got there, could you tell us a little bit about what led you into getting the deal with the World Wrestling Federation, where you spent several years?
Well, I can say that almost all the good luck that happened to me was directly because I am the brother of the immortal Macho Man Randy Savage.
Macho Man Randy Savage, of course, went to the World Wrestling Federation from the Memphis territory, and he had quite a bit of success. You and he were both there for a long time, but when you first got to the World Wrestling Federation, it had only been a year and a half, 2 years since they started their national push. What did you think of the way things were being ran when you first got there?
It was like a night and day difference between anything I had seen before and anything I was about to see. I never remember Vince McMahon with where I ever thought he needed to shine his shoes. I never saw him where he needed to use dental floss. I never saw a hair out of place. And in the ring, if there was a piece of lint on his ring, somebody would tell somebody and that person would be fired. He insisted on meticulous rings, the turnbuckle poles were always painted in whatever color they were supposed to be. He had a great attention to detail, and it showed.
the travel that was involved for people working for the WWF back then was really, really insane. You were all over the map going from coast to coast and into Canada and sometimes overseas. It's nothing like it is now where they have 3 or 4 days off in a week. It was a 7-day-a-week touring company, and they didn't necessarily match up their touring schedule with a map to see what towns made the most sense. It was all over the place. Can you take us through what it was like, not only just as a performer, but just the physical and mental toll that the travel schedule was taking on guys back then?
Well, some people cannot take the pressure. I could. I didn't think it was really hard work compared to a coal miner who has to lower himself into the bowels of the earth. And if the canary dies, that means he's dead too. And I just thought it was a fantastic adventure. I did not know how long it was going to last, so I decided to enjoy every moment of it and save all the money I could.
WWF was different than a lot of wrestling companies that were running back then. Not very many companies merchandise themselves. If they did, they would have maybe a T-shirt, maybe a hat available, usually some programs, but not much more than that. The WWF had the action figure lines. They had T-shirts, sweatshirts, ties. You had your own Frisbee at one point available. How much of a difference do you think it made to the individual wrestlers working there that the WWF had really delved into the merchandising aspect of what wrestling could be as opposed to every other territory?
Well, everything that Vince touched turned to gold. And it was just, even though I was sucking hind tit on the sow, as they say in the farm, I managed to get quite fat on what I was doing. And I was always very appreciative, and I'm glad I got to last so long in the company. And if they called me today, I would say yes today.
And when the fans that are listening today that are younger and may not realize it, or fans that have kind of forgotten this, a lot of the wrestling promoters at the time didn't necessarily like the direction that the World Wrestling Federation was going. They didn't really understand the marketing aspect of it. They didn't really understand cable television was going into homes all across the country rather than it being a regionalized television market. There were a lot of aspects happening that the World Wrestling Federation really took advantage of that other wrestling promotions did not, and the promoters didn't necessarily understand or like that direction. Did you get a lot of feedback from other promoters or other wrestlers in different companies trying to understand what it was that you were doing in the WWF?
Well, by that time, all the other promotions were slowly disintegrating. You know, the competition was dying a slow death. And whatever jealousy they might have felt at the time, you know, Ole Anderson wrote a book, how corporate America turned inside out, the wrestling business or whatever. If you don't want to waste 400 pages, it was just, I was the greatest, everybody else is lousy. That's the clip note of the book. You know, that encapsulated, get off the top of the mountain I want to get on. Only try to take over the world, and Vince actually did.
One of the urban legends that has come out in the last few years since a lot of wrestlers have written books and done shoot interviews and have done interviews with different forms of media, is allegedly Harley Race took umbrage with what the World Wrestling Federation was doing when they went to Kansas City, where he owned part of that territory. And according to the urban legend, and depending on what you believe, he confronted Hulk Hogan in the locker room over this, and then may have caused some type of disturbance out in front of the fans before finally leaving and letting the show proceed. Were you privy to anything that somebody like Harley Race may have done to actually go down to a WWF show and try to create trouble?
Well, I tell you what, it wouldn't surprise me at all, because I know he's the type of guy to do that. He's afraid of nobody. But then later on down the line, Harley Race is a star in the WWE, WWF, whatever you call it. He was King Harley Race, the real world champion, you know, and so he may have had an issue with Hulk Hogan, but they certainly did business later on. So did Terry Funk, so did Dory Funk Jr. All the members of the NWA eventually, if they could, got a ride on the WWE train.
Well, we have been joined by someone I believe you also know, so I want to bring her on. And do we have another member of the World Wrestling Federation alumni roster with us?
Is it okay to say hello? Hey, Lanny, how are you doing?
Very good. Who am I talking to?
Making his way toward the ring area. Did that give you a little bit of a hint?
I have a feeling I know you. And
yes.
you are a very beautiful woman, and you are the daughter of one of the greatest promoters of all time.
Well, you're so kind. Thank you.
Could it be the beautiful Mike McGurk?
Both of us are second generation. So I used to have many conversations with your brother about that, and growing up in the business and around our fathers. And then I had a few times that I got to ride in the car with you, too. You know that, and I think the world of this person. I love Lanny, and I think he knows that. There's just a common bond that that you have. It's an understood bond that we have. How is everybody doing? And thank you for inviting me to be a part of this.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Our pleasure.
It was not an unrequited love. It was not one-way street. I reciprocate 100%, and I'll tell you what. How's everybody doing? Well, I've lost everybody in my family, but my daughter and my son-in-law have blessed me with a 15-month-old baby boy. I am a grandfather.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Now, how does that feel? Isn't it wonderful?
Well, God takes away, but he gives you back. So I'm very, very happy. And my daughter doesn't like any publicity, so we're not going to give her any, because, you know, some other fans are, you know, they're not exactly the kind of people you want over at your house, you know. But anyway, I'm just very excited about, they said, what do you want them to call you? And I said, how about abuelo? It's Spanish for grandfather. And I'm not Spanish,
sure.
But it sounds so cool.
That's great. Yeah, there's abuelo and abuela. So you are the abuelo.
Yes, the abuela is divorced from me. But that's all right.
Yes.
We're going to.
I was just hearing the very end of the conversation that you were having about like Harley Race and some of the others. And I think you too, Lanny, knew before a lot of the wrestlers went into the WWF / WWE, we'll just know it as WWF, that they came from different territories that we used to have around in our continental United States. And so a lot of them were very protective of that job and that territory, such as Harley Race. And I can remember when I started out, and I wasn't announcing yet. I was doing everything that I could just to make money, including which brought me to the WWF, was pulling the ring and supplying a wrestling ring. And I can remember going into Kansas City, which was a territory and where Harley Race was currently wrestling and had interest in that business. And so they did not, you know, it was not really well regarded when WWF came flowing through the United States and into these promoters' territories. I can remember I was met with not a wide open doors. There were some challenges to it, and sometimes your tires would be flashed, and you know, it just, they didn't want you there. And without a ring, there's not going to be a show. And I think that I had one instance, even in my own home state, where an opposing promoter, which we will nameless, if anybody in the business or as a wrestling fan, you know your history, you could look it up. Anyway, there was a ring that had started being erected and going up in Oklahoma City that was doomed. It's not a ring that was going to be staying up for any length of time. And I think that was something that I recognized, wasn't privy to that. I wasn't used to running opposition, so to speak. So when I went in there to put my ring up, this ring was already there. And within an hour, I learned very quickly about what was ahead. And that ring was taken down, and my ring went up. So I think just with the mental fortitude that I had is like, no, wait a minute, I came there for a payday, and these people aren't taking it away from me. So it started like that. So I can tell you that it, just like Lanny said, eventually everyone came to the WWF because the territories themselves were gone. They were leaving. And it was, you couldn't survive and have your television program going on at the time. You had your Atlanta wrestling coming in, and this was just all right there before, you know, you had your locals every week. We ran a show every week. And it was so saturated with wrestling that it became to where eventually your numbers went down and you closed the doors. And Vince obviously took over, and then it became just Vince and Georgia. Lanny, what was your take on it? I mean, you remember those days.
Well, Mike, I was just so happy to be part of it. You know, it was, I never ever thought I would ever get to go to Madison Square Garden to wrestle. And I wound up making 23 appearances there, and two of them in the main event. So when I think about different wrestlers, a lot of them gave more than they got in this life. I'm one of the few people that can say I got more than I gave.
I absolutely believe that. I would have never dreamed at the time that it was approached to me that if I had a ring, because, again, you all must go back and think that this was new for Vince, and he was counting on people. He didn't have the rings. He didn't have he was just starting out. So your localized people, he would call, or not he himself, but other people that had worked for my dad, and that's how I got in, is a guy named Terry Garvin. And he called my parents and wanted to know if I had a wrestling, if they had a wrestling ring, and indeed would we'd like to rent it. And that's how I started, and then it just grew into where, and it was about me making all the money that I could, not just setting up the ring, but it was something that I was born around, but I never announced. I never sat at ringside. Lanny, you can attest to that. When your parents are running the show, those are for paying customers. You don't sit there in those seats. So, and I would collect the ring jackets. I would do anything that I could think that would make it easier for the promotion, for the promoter as they were coming in, and for the guys themselves, so that they had a tough enough time on the road. Meeting those flights, coming in, going out to the gym, coming back, and then working. So that's how I literally started and did that. And I think just being consistent and being there, then that's how it fell into it. But I was starting to announce, and what happened was I'd already been pulling the ring for about 2 years, and I was in Memphis, Tennessee, home of Elvis Presley, of course, and we were in the Mid-South Coliseum, and there was a radio disc jockey that was in the ring. It was a pretty big show. It had Andre. We had, I think even Hulk was there, but it was a big WWF show, and this guy, it was a radio announcer that got in the middle of the ring, and I'm sure they had traded out some kind of publicity and promotion for him to be able to do that. And he got up and just started acting like a clown. And one of the agents, Jack Lanza, came up. And, of course, I was already set to just keep time, do the jackets, run the music. And he looked at me and he said, "You're announcing." I had never announced in my life. I didn't even think about it. And, of course, at that time, I didn't know. I thought, "Oh my God, how am I going to do this?" And he said, "That guy's out." And he said, "You know what you're doing. You've been up there. You know what you're doing. Well, are you going to say no? I don't know what I'm doing. No, you just take it and run with it." And that's what I did. And I don't think it was my own voice. I don't even think that I was, you know, I know I was on air, because to me, Lanny, every one of the guys that have put themselves inside that squared circle, I am in awe of. They are the ones that's putting their body out there, I don't care what they say. It, to me, that's what always put the clothes on my back, is those fans and the guys that went out there and busted their butts for their families to make a dollar, and many dollars as it grew to be. But so I wanted to make sure that what I was doing was doing them right, and that they got the proper introduction. I wasn't out there for Mike McGurk. I was out there for those guys and to give them a good introduction and a good show. You know, if I'm out there acting like a clown, these people paid hard money, good hard money, to come and see you. It's professional wrestling. So there's professionalism in it. So I got it, and that's how it started. And I always wore a man's tuxedo until years later that we finally got into the spandex. It was a lot easier to care for, too, and lighter to wear. But I think, too, I took the attitude to watching it all the time growing up and how the announcers portrayed themselves and how they carried themselves. And I just kind of put that all together of what the fans would like to hear, and put that together with bringing the guys out.
Well, Mr. Poffo, I know that the WWF was doing a lot of television at that point. You were on not only shows like Primetime Wrestling and All-American Wrestling on cable, but you had the syndicated shows when syndication was absolutely huge. Did you notice a difference in where you were wrestling previously as far as just your day-to-day life being recognized and people knowing who you were compared when you got to the WWF and the television was just a monster at that point.
Well, let me tell you a little story. I was traveling with my brother and Miss Elizabeth, and we were running to a plane in O'Hare Airport in Chicago. And everybody was freaking out because it was the Macho Man and Miss Elizabeth. I promise you, if I would have been naked, nobody would have noticed me. Because everybody was looking at the Macho Man and Elizabeth. And I was also running, but nobody cared about me. So when you talk about fame, let's not get carried away. I was the invisible man that day, and I understood that what it is to be famous and what it is to be not so famous.
Mike McGurk, did you have a big difference as far as recognition in your day-to-day life once you got to the WWF?
Are you talking to me?
Yes.
Yeah, I can. Oh my! Tell you, it was from day to night. I mean, at the very beginning, and a lot of them, it was only because I would be recognized if I was around the wrestlers. if I would come back home, it didn't happen until much later, maybe after I'd been with them 4 or 5 years, that I began to know just how really big it was. But, any time that I would be with and traveling on the flights with the guys, now not obviously when I was pulling the ring or anything like that, but once I was elevated to get to go on the flights with the guys, then they would put it together. And I mean, the thing that I knew is when I went over to and made a European tour, and I mean, these people, it was crazy. We had to have security. I remember people as we were being ushered back into the buses. But, I mean, there were people that were grabbing your hair and just to get a piece of it. And I thought, oh, my God. You had no idea, until you get around in those kind of situations, just how really, really big it was. And, I can't imagine just like what Randy and Liz and even, and I know Lainey, he saw it firsthand. Just going from what we were used to, and as kids, to always defend wrestling, and then to have it completely turn around to where it was growing and it was so accepted and sought after, and it was just almost it still is. It's still a satisfaction to know that it was something that I grew up with and loved. Obviously, I ended up in it as much as I could without being in the ring wrestling, because my dad had always said, no way, no way, even when I was a little girl. But I loved it. I loved the people. I loved how I grew up to where so many kids are not exposed to all the I was exposed to pizza when I was a little girl, because Mario Galento was cooking pizza, and that was these wrestlers that came from different countries with their families and different foods, different languages. I would see, some of the kids, because they traveled with their families, and you would stay in a territory for months at a time, and I mean, there's different traditions that these families would have, and it grows you as a person, but I could never believe how it was going to grow like it did, and just the sheer size of it. I remember we were in Kansas City at the Kemper Arena, and the thing, it was sold out, and it was a foggy night, and Hulk couldn't get in. And, I mean, you just turn around and you look around everywhere you saw, there were seats taken, and it's a very big building. We were from the days of having you know, 5,000 and 6,000 people. That's a really big show. And my dad held a the first wrestling show was held in Louisiana at the Superdome, was held and promoted by my dad and his partner at the time, Bill Watts. So I can remember that, and it was not filled, okay? But they had a pretty good show of probably half the size, but they didn't have these big super shows. That was the beginning of it. I can remember that was like 1976. I was down there looking at the – I still have pictures of my dad and I, Bill, looking at this huge block building. So, yeah, when you say the popularity of it and just the sheer magnitude of the television, and now, I mean, it even goes further into now to where these kids – the last show that I had worked, I mean, this kid's like 12 years old, and I've been off the television since, you know, 1994, and they remember you, and it's, you know why? It's because of the tapes and everything that is still out there that's saturating the market, and I love it. I never thought about it, you know, when I was working in the 80s and 90s. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have this stuff, so you didn't realize back then what it was going to be and still what it is. I mean, you're asking me to be a part of this still now, and I love it to be a part, to be able to tell people what it was like. And I feel just barely enough to be able to talk about it compared to Lainey and his experiences.
One of the things that the fans that are newer fans have found out and the advent of, you know, all these books and shoot interviews and podcasts and so forth, are there are a few famous stories of locker room fights that came out of the WWF in the late 80s and the early 90s. You had Jacques Rougeau and Dynamite Kid had a famous one. Danny Spivey and Adrian Adonis. But just and as a general rule, did you see very many actual locker room fights break out? I know the guys were always, you know, on the road. They were worn down. Tempers flared, I'm sure. But did you see actual honest-to-goodness locker room fights very much going on back then?
Well, I'd like to answer that question. It's really amazing that in 1983 I worked for Bill Watts, and I was told that if you broke up a fight, you would be fired. He liked fighting. He liked the boys fighting each other. And if you were to break them up, you would lose your job. Where Vince McMahon, you can lose your job if you fought. He had a totally different attitude. In fact, Danny Spivey lost his job because he beat up Adrian Adonis. And very famous, Vince was on the phone with him at the, and he said, well, I cannot have you beating up my talent. And Danny Spivey said, well, I don't consider that blank, blank, blank talented. And Vince says, turn in your tickets and go home. And now the good news was Terry Funk was there and immediately made a phone call and booked Danny Spivey in Japan, where Danny did very, very well. So, you know, all's well that ends well. But the Jacques Rougeau thing, that was not a fight. That was a punch, one punch, no response. And Jacques had taken as much as, just like Popeye, that's all I can stand, I can't stand no more. Dun, 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 eat a can of spinach and pound. You know, that was, is there an ambulance?
yeah, one just went by my place, sorry about that.
That's okay if I need help. But anyway, I cannot stay too much longer I've got a previous engagement, so if you don't mind, five more minutes if you ask me some more questions, and then Mike McGirt can carry it on from here.
Hey, Lanny.
Yes?
Before you leave, hey, this is what you do. We never know. We're not promised tomorrow, right? And I just want to tell you, I love you, and I hope to see you soon, because every time that I do see him, it's family to me, and you are, and I love you dearly. You be well, and enjoy that abuelo status that you have now.
Okay, Mike McGirt, I love you. I love you too, and you. Thank you for always being nice to me. But I will answer one more question from our host, and then I must say goodbye. But I hope to see you soon. Where are you living? Are you still in Oklahoma?
I'm still in Oklahoma, and hopefully I've got plans. I'm going to come down your way. If you're in Florida, that's where I'm headed by fall.
I'm living in Clearwater, Florida now. I'm walking distance between Whole Foods and Crunch Fitness. So I'm where my brother achieved immortality through his wrestling. I'm going to try to achieve it through not dying. I'm going to try to keep myself in shape. And even if it's a fool's game, you know, like, of course, I'm going to try to, that's all I do is read about health foods and, you know, trying to do the right thing for myself. But if you're in Clearwater, which is not far from the biggest city near us is Tampa, just
right.
Just give me a call, and it's you can go on my website, geniuslannypoppo.com, and you can reach me through there if you're going to be in town. I'll make sure that I'm going to take you someplace nice.
I know you would. I know. There's no doubt in my mind.
Why?
You're the genius.
Full of glory and renown. Okay, I will answer one more question, Ben.
Well, I want to actually give that time that you have to you, and if there's anything you want to say to the people listening today, plug and promote anything you have going on, social medias, upcoming appearances, anything like that, please feel free.
Okay, June the 2nd, I'm going to be, let's see. June the 2nd, I'm going to be in Providence, Rhode Island. June the 16th, I'm going to be in Hamilton, Ohio, because I got a new comic book that is out, and I'm going to be selling them in Hamilton, Ohio. And July 29th, Tower, Minnesota. August 18th, I'm going to be touring Scotland. September 1st, I'm hoping to be in Chicago. We'll see. Ring of Honor. September 22nd, Danville, Virginia. October 13th and 14th, Hamilton, Ontario. And in November, I'll be touring Germany. So I just want to say, I want to finish with the poem I inducted my brother into the Hall of Fame with. I stand before the Hall of Fame in honor of my brother, who sees each Carpe Diem day with passion like no other. Born Randy Mario Poffo, he became the Macho Man. Randy Savage made it cool to be a wrestling fan. His match with Ricky Steamboat in 1987 was on a scale from 1 to 10, much better than 11. He snapped into a Slim Jim with his iconic voice. He earned a role in Spider-Man, which made his fans rejoice. When the mega powers exploded, the storyline was real. Life's too short to hold a grudge. It's time for us to heal. In triumphant jubilation, we celebrate his name. Finally, the Macho Man is in the Hall of Fame. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Mike McGirt. Give me a call. GeniusLannyPoppo.com. Check it out.
I love you.
And
I will.
I love you. And God bless you and yours. And I will
God
say, I will bid adieu now. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you very
Bye-bye.
Much, Mr. Poffo. Well, Mike McGirt, the WWF in the early 90s, it was still a huge machine, but things were a little bit different than they had been in the late 80s heydays. Business was down just a little bit. The house show attendance, not quite as strong necessarily. The scandals, of course, were affecting things. But from someone in your position as the ring announcer doing the syndicated challenge, and I'm sure you did some of the prime times and so forth, had anything really changed as far as your day-to-day job that you were doing as part of the WWF?
No, not really. As it got on later, it did. But, the only thing that we noticed as far as change is our television. Maybe we would change whether, when I started, we were doing, Saturday night main event, but also, too, we were filming our television shows. We would do three shows every 3 weeks. So that one night we would start out at 7 o'clock and we probably wouldn't get the people out till about midnight because we were throwing 3 weeks of shows in a can. And so it was busy. I noticed that as it was going along that it was getting a little bit more corporate, and that happened when more like in 92 where I was losing more touch with Vince, and it was harder to, because of my whole existence, my whole start was exclusively through Vince, and we had worked literally on a handshake and a promise, and he never ever failed on that until we got into about the last year. And they were hiring more and more people that were not in the business, people that didn't understand the business. And when I started, it was people that was made up of the business and had wrestled somewhere before, but they were people that knew the business and was very close to it and guided Vince very well, where Linda, his wife, was more of the business end of it. And very well at it, and marketing and everything else. And I noticed that the things that would change would be the things that were like of the social issues. They were always worried about if I was harassed, and I thought, if I didn't have. If I didn't have sexual harassment, I'd never get a compliment. I used to tell them that, but it was never like what they think. You got to take it in context. If the guys would tell you, which was it wasn't all the time. And it's like telling the other guy, cause I was one of the guys, it's like telling them, hey, your trunks look good on you. Well, they're not going to be doing that. Well, I don't think so, but if one of them would step out and say, just under his breath and say, hey, looking hot tonight. And, that made my night, because that was my contemporaries. That was, people that I worked with and that I valued what they thought. Obviously, I would love to have heard something from Vince, and I would, at the first, I would go each night after I was through and go back to the dressing room and I would ask, to Vince, hey, how did I do? And it was a nod and a wink, but and then it got to be, I think I was probably just hassled him to death. But I was never knowing, because it was, but I learned later why, is because he wanted me to develop in it, and he didn't want to guide me. He wanted me just to be Mike and bring it. And the only thing he ever said, he goes, you can be more animated if you'd like. But I was, so many people thought that I knew what was going to go on in the ring. I did not know. I didn't know if they were going to work an ankle. And I was going to be in the middle of it with Wimpleman or anybody else. I just went with it. And I never knew about Bobby saying the things that he did until later. Of course, I listened to the tapes, but to me, Bobby did the best thing that anybody could ever ask for, and I never asked for it. He did it on his own, and he put me over by knocking me so many times, you know. He really put me over, and I'm just sorry that I was never able to thank him, but I think he, you know, it was understood because he was just exactly like that in real life, behind the scenes. Because, you know, I would be with Bobby and the guys. We would have to be at the arena from probably, 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, and we wouldn't leave till midnight. So you're around, you know, you're around them all day long. And I used to, if I wasn't announcing that night, then I would be in as working as a production assistant and getting the guys lined up to shoot their promos. So Bobby was always quick-witted and quick talking, and so you know that stayed the same. But I could see that our rules, such as the sexual harassment, so much of this stuff was starting to come into it that had never been in it before. And that was when we started feeling the growth that, you know, and too, I think a lot of it Linda saw, you know, she was going to protect the company. And working the way that we did and having more people, you had, you know, other women that came in that didn't last long versus Sherry, myself, and Liz. So they had to be careful. And, again, as you grow, those kind of things presented itself, and you had to be careful. Of course, I would have never thought of sexual harassment. I mean, and that's the truth. I never experienced that from these guys. And, of course, I don't want to let out some of their secrets of how nice they were to me. But, you know, Haku would be one that that I would be on the plane, and the guys would, back then when they used to serve you food, and maybe I was overlooked or the flight attendant, you know, was enamored with the guys, and it was like, hey, you know, hey, I'm with them. But and Haku would toss me, you know, maybe his yogurt and a banana over to me, and but the guys were good to me. Now, did they carry my bags? Heck, no. I used to tell Liz, I said, "You got us so good, kid. I mean, you know, you got a man that loves you and carries your bags, and here I'm dragging mine. Me and Sherry, of course, Sherry could take care of herself and ten of me, and so the guys weren't supposed to take care of the women. You know, that wasn't the job. It was Randy's job, but otherwise, if you could step up and you entered this profession and you're Leroy's daughter, I think you probably know how to do it, and you're not, you know, and I never expected it. So if they were, you know, nice to me, that was, and they were, I don't know, there probably was maybe three out of all of them that I ever worked with that might have been uneducated to the fact of how to treat me, and I took it on my own to you just demand it, you know. If they're not treating you right, then I don't treat them right, so I just ignore them. But I think, as you're saying, I saw so much change because the bigger that we got, the more rules that we ended up with. And we had to be so careful about who we talked to. And, you know, at the beginning, talk to everybody and put yourself over. But then it began, don't let too much of you out, because they would take advantage of you and the stories would come out and it was not, you know, wasn't worded right. They'd misconstrue what you had said. So, yeah, that kind of protection came into it. You bet. A lot of changes. And of course, then we had, God, one show we were at, Geraldo had some of his people down and trying to find out about steroids. And come on, you know, just cheap shots. And you just, you know, told them to go away and get a real job. And we always had testing for drugs. We always did that, all the way down to me. So that became a little bit more concentrated as far as being careful and watching out the media more of your testing So all of that to keep us clean and keep us the image that Vince was trying to portray that we had, which sometimes became a little difficult. But I would say almost in every aspect did it change as we grew. And then as we grew, then the money became better, and it became a little bit more, there was more dissension, because if somebody was making more than the other, they should have never known anyway. But with that, as in anything, when the money becomes bigger, sometimes the egos become inflated, and they lose sight of that this is still showmanship. And, no matter what, you could be erased and gone the next day. And that was a huge, and I've seen it. And I you don't say anything. You can't. They just didn't work out for whatever reasons. And usually, like some of the girls that came in, I think they were so enamored with the wrestlers, which caused them problems because they'd end up taking their tops off and singing on the piano, you know, at 1 o'clock in the morning at the bar, and they're gone. So you just don't do that. Just the rules. And then as it came to the 90s, 92, 93, and the steroid use, and they were really, really, really coming down after us, it was changing. And then you saw the Ted Turner dynamic where he had started his production, and, you know, some of our guys was leaving. So it was changing. It was definitely changing. I loved the good old days. I loved all of them. Don't ever get me wrong, because it's in anything. We were growing, and that's a good thing. Sometimes with growth, you have other things that enter into it that is not so pleasant. But, that's part of it. That's part of life and anything. That's understood. You're going to have change. And if you can't grow with it and go with it, then you either lose or you go home, or you win and you stay and you adapt. Some of them can't, and that's the thing that I could never understand, a lot of them. But, I get it to where they live the character, but when they become the character and they cross that fine line is where I saw a lot of change with your younger talent that had not been in the business, as compared to Lanny, as compared to Randy, Ted, all of us, because we grew up in it, and we knew, hey, I would tease him. I'd say, so, Ted, what's it like when you go home and your wife says, hey, you got to take out the trash? I said, how does the million-dollar man act about that? So, I was trying to get him to realize, hey, we're settled down here. We're in a... you're not really a million-dollar man. You're Ted. And the same thing, when I would come home and I'd come to Tulsa, and I remember when I would walk off the plane that was my time. That was over, the stage curtain, that closed, and I became just Mike McGurk from Tulsa, Oklahoma. But then when I would leave, and I remember getting on that plane a lot of times, and as soon as I'd hear that door shut, it was time to go to work. And, the things that you would normally do when you were not on the road, you couldn't do on the road because people were watching. And there was people that were jealous. There were people that wanted to take you down. And that's another thing as we got bigger. When I first started, nobody wanted to take me down. It was tough trying to get the job from Mel Phillips that was announcing. But, I was talking to Vince, and it's like, Vince, we're not selling sex here, obviously, and I'm covered up. But yet when they see a female, and I've got a pretty good, strong voice, and it worked. But it had to be Vince's idea, and it eventually came around to where Vince liked it. And then that's when he decided to change up the costumes, do some stuff, because it's so funny to hear this when I talk about, I remember Sherry had some wild clothes on that had like both of her her butt cheeks open, you know, it was like cutouts. And they're like, and Vince is like, no, we can't do that. And made her go get fishnet hose to cover it up. So, you know, which would be nothing today. But, yeah, we, a lot of times that he would have to wrangle Sherry in on her clothing, which was fun. So
well,
sorry about that, guys.
I believe my co-host QT is standing by, and I think QT has a couple of questions, so I'm going to pass things along to him.
Okay. I got about 5 minutes.
Well, thank you, Sun Guy. Hello, Mike.
Hi.
Mike, one of the most seminal moments in our show's history was when we had on B. Brian Blair. Now, I hope you're... split from B. Brian was amicable, and can I ask you a question about him?
Sure. Absolutely. I love Brian. I always will.
Oh, okay. Well, now on our show, I told Mr. Blair that there was one time that Paul McCartney once pulled up to Heathrow Airport in a no parking zone. He got out of his limo and went into the airport to conduct business. He came out 30 minutes later to find several bobbies or London policemen at his no parking zone. Instead of giving him a ticket, the bobbies asked him for autographs. And in another incident of front of the line privileges, soccer star Dave Beckham was in a DMV office in his native England, and instead of standing in line, he bypassed all the people and went right to the front of the counter. I then told Brian that I, QT Vokes, would try to get him front of the line privileges in general life. Mike, will you join us in this endeavor to get B. Brian Blair front of the line privileges like he deserves?
Did Brian ask for that?
No, I took it upon myself to get him front of the line privileges. Yes.
Well, I believe that Brian should have front of the line privileges. Now, as for me to get front of the line privileges, I had to become a flight attendant, and every time I would do that, it was like, you know, I got it legally, you know. But yeah, how can I help? That's what I need to say, is how can I help put Brian front of the line privileges?
Well, first of all, Sign Guy and myself are taking up a petition to get B. Brian Blair front of the line privileges. So I think we can send you a copy of this. Yes.
Well, sure. Is it something that Brian's having an issue with?
Well, at first he asked us if it was a rib or not. Yes.
That's what I'm wondering. Because the Brian that I know would gladly give his front-of-the-line privileges up to anybody that needed it. He's that giving of a person. And, oh, yeah, the problem and the regret that you should not have regret. And it's the only thing that – one of the things that I do is that at the time that – we were married, and my dad was still promoting, and it was still hard to explain because Bell's days were, in my dad's eyes, were in mind because he was blind, but he thought, oh, man, my daughter's married to him, and they're going to think that, you know, Brian's going to be put over, but yet Brian was good talent. So there was that dynamic that my dad had to work out, and of course Bill Watts was not a fan of mine. I think it was just because I was born and I was probably in the way and saw a lot of things that Bill did, and I was my dad's eyes, and I became enemy number one, and I became somewhat of a liability to him. He wanted me out of the way. Well, then I met Brian, and you know, in his and Brian and Bill's mind, oh God, here's the guy. Here's here's the opening she's looking for, which was true, is somebody that could take the business, run it with my dad, and Bill could go on his happy way. Well, Bill was not about to go anywhere. And, in fact, while I was married to Brian, Bill Watts fired my parents and sent a messenger to the house while we were all there and told them that they were locked out of their office and their things would be packed up and sent to them. And that's the beginning of the split. So here's this happy couple that we went for our honeymoon. We went to Hawaii, but we went there to work because Ed Francis at the time was the promoter. So I thought, well, this is great. My dad got Brian booked over there. We were over there for 3 weeks, almost 4 weeks, and then he worked 3 days a week. And it was Don Morocco, which I loved Don, loved him, and just and we were in Hawaii. How do you mess that up? So we came back, and then when all of this was happening, you've got this kind of pressure of a person that is just now, you know, he drew the line in the sand, so to speak. And you've got a marriage that has just started, and he's young. We're both young, and he still wants to wrestle. He doesn't really want to be a promoter. He loves being with the boys, and that's not the position that he needed to be in. It just didn't work. And then when he had to, like my dad would say, he needs a rest. And I think this was a lot of Bill Watts. And he says, you need to get him booked somewhere. So he would get him booked up in Kansas City. And then when he got him booked with the Von Erichs, you can imagine what kind of time I was having, because there's got four drop-dead, handsome, beautiful guys that I've grown up with, the Von Erichs, and my husband's down there with them, and they're single. He's not. And so it began, you know, to – and the pressure that I had trying to still be with my parents, run the box office, watch the promotion, and knowing that we were going through different promoters coming in and going out all the while, well, Bill was running opposition to us and then eventually took our television. And when I say took it, we had contracted our television to run, and he went in there and offered more money. And it was this sinking ship, so to speak. And that was another pressure. And I think, too, Brian, it was just too much, and it was too much on me. And then on top of that, my dad had a 2,400-acre cattle ranch, and that's where Brian and I were staying and trying to operate that, which is nearly impossible, and then be on the road and then come home late at night and maybe work cattle earlier in the morning and then get on the road. It's a lot to ask of a young man, I didn't have a choice. I just did it, and eventually it wore him down. But, you know, my parents are gone, and when I went over to Brian when his first year at the CAC, Cauliflower Alley Club, I was there to support him. And, you know, he's the only one that I can really still talk to about my parents and what we went through. And, you know, he'll always be my husband in terms of because we were kids. But and then when we worked together, you know, and here I was in the business and he was coming on, and I'm running the ring, and I see him every night. And it was different. And my mom and he talked long after we were divorced, and I didn't really want the divorce. I really didn't. But there was no way that the marriage could survive with me living here and him going back to Tampa. And I had to give in, and reluctantly so, but we still, the respect is there. And I definitely know how he feels about me and me to him. So, it's very amicable, and I appreciate that. Any chance that I get to talk about Brian, I do.
Well, guys, we're pretty much out of time here. So, Ms. McGurk, I would like to give you the opportunity as well, if there's anything you want to say to the listeners, if you want to plug and promote absolutely anything at all, floor is all yours.
Well, that's great, and I thank you all for including me so much. I didn't mean to just take the floor over, but gosh, every chance I get to talk about it, I think it's you can tell through how I talk and how I love the business, and I still do, and the people that are in it and going forward with it. As far as me, I am available. I would love for anybody that would like to have me. I am on Facebook. I am on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. And it's somebody's got MikeMcGurk.com, and that's not me. So it's one Mike McGurk. And I've got the MikeMcGurk.com. I'm trying to get all of it covered. So if anybody's looking for me, but I'm available for bookings. I have done shows back east. I do little shows I've done shows in Texas and do personal appearances as often as I can, and a lot of them will just have me there to talk like what we are here. So I am available, would love it, and I appreciate the fans still with their interest of wanting to know what it was like and how I got there and how it was to be with the wrestlers, which was great, and I appreciate it, and God bless all of you all. And be good to each other, and keep watching wrestling. And the good old days are out there. I still watch them as if they were brand new to me. You know, I mean, I can look at them, and it'll be people send me the tapes all the time, and I'm like, oh my God, you know, that was a great match. So, but thank you all so much. Have a very happy. It is. A very happy Memorial Day, and safe to all of you, please. And please reach out to me, and I try to get back to you. A lot of times it's probably 3 or 4 months. I'll go through them and think, oh, my God. But just bear with me. I'll answer. Eventually I'll answer your emails. I'll get there. But come see me.
Well,
I've got a promoter out there that would like to have me. I'll be there.
Absolutely. I want to thank you once again for taking the time today to be with us. It was appreciated. Thanks also to Lenny Poffo for taking time out of his schedule to be with us here today. Fans, jump on your WWE networks. Check out some of the older footage that they have there. It's a treasure trove of great things. WWF and the mid to late 80s, into the mid 90s is absolutely phenomenal. Check out Mike McGurk's work, past and present. Check out Lanny Poffo. He was definitely way ahead of his time. You can find me in Bremerton, Washington tomorrow for the Pro Wrestling Federation. So come see what we're doing out there in Bremerton. Buy a T-shirt or two if you need something to wear tomorrow. And wherever there's pro wrestling near you, go support it. Find a show. There's lots out there this week, and support what they're doing on the independent professional wrestling circuit. And we will talk to you next week. We will be back here with you on Sunday. We have Joseph Schwartz returning to the program. And 1 week from today, it's the return to our program of the Beast Dan Severn. So it should be good times in the next week or so. And we will talk to you later.
Bye-bye.